So keep me honest throughout this thing, please. I really appreciate the invite, and thank you. This is an important group to talk to. And when we were going back and forth on what topics might be working, it occurred to me that, you know, it's being the usual academic that I have, we have to start with high theory and such. But there's some real interesting stuff going on in libraries, as you all know. And librarians, the conferences I go to, spend a lot of time hand-wringing and such. And I figured it was time to bring the angst to you guys as well. Because as I was preparing for this presentation, I did my homework, and I came across your vision statement. And I love this vision statement, by the way. Not that you need to say good things about it, but we'd like to see a library community in New York State where library assistants have a voice in decision-making that affect their future and valued contributions recognized and rewarded appropriately, where there is equitable access to professional development opportunities, lots of other really good stuff. And then the association should be a place of competent professionalism and of community where our members can come secure in the knowledge that they can be welcome for who they are, included actively and meaningful in decisions that affect their lives, provide quality services they need, and challenge to realize their best hopes, dreams, and aspirations. I love that statement. And it got me thinking, one, I want to take this, particularly this last challenge to realize their best hopes, dreams, and aspirations, and I think that's a really great mission statement for libraries in general. And so one of the things that we've been talking about sort of on lots of different fronts is what is the role of the library as we move forward? And it's a conversation that needs to be had, yes, with librarians, but also with boards of trustees and libraries assistants and municipal governments and people who fund us and all of these things. And so expanding the conversation is very important. Because one of the lines that I take away from that about wanting to be included in decision-making means that it's both an opportunity, an obligation, and a challenge, right? If you're part of the conversation, you become responsible for part of that decision-making. And it also means that you're responsible for knowing what's going on as part of that. And I think we've all hit people who would love to have a job where they don't have to think. And I think it's probably not the group that we want to be working with on a regular basis. And it happens at all tiers. So what I thought we could do today is spend a little bit of time talking about possible futures of the library, talking about some of the obligations, because as we all know, libraries, no one here is ever concerned about their job, because we're all going to be put out of business by this, right? Kindles are going to put us out. Before Kindles, it was Google was going to be putting us out of business. Before that, it was bookstores were going to be putting out of business. I think if we go far enough back, it was like the papyrus printers in Egypt were going to put us out of business. So this is the threat of the day. And it's real discussion. At one time, I wrote a paper called Fear and Loathing in Library Land. You know, there was this whole suite of conferences where you go to about how Google was going to outdo us and put us out of business on a regular basis. And yet, we're still here. In fact, it's interesting when you read things like Slate talking about how public libraries are going to be obsolete in 10 years, etc. You hear this a lot, right? E-readers and e-books are going to put us out of business. And all this, everything's going to put us out of business. And at the same time, reconcile that with statistics like a 61% increase in circulation over from 94 to 2004. And what's interesting is you look at the graph, it's going up and getting steeper since then, right? How do you reconcile the fact that we're going to be put out of business when you have reports coming out talking about net positive economic impacts, right? It's one thing to talk about kids and reading and literacy, but we're about economic development. We're New York State, for God's sake. We have 300 economic development organizations per square feet. But we have something to talk about in terms of enriching communities. An overwhelmingly positive impression of libraries. And this is just one simple statistic. There was a group that had a study out of the Institute for Museum and Library Services, and what they did was they went and they asked people, what internet resources do you find the most trustworthy, right? The higher you get on this graph, you can move up to extreme trustworthy is the top, you know, not at all trustworthy at the bottom. Now, I know you can't read the little things, so I'll do it for you here. And we'll start at the low end, which is personal websites. If I go to a personal website, not going to trust it too much. Then you get into things like commercial websites. You then get into government websites. And you go through museums. And then finally you hit the last one, which is libraries. This statistic, this little line, out of a couple thousand people they asked, is important. And one of the things that we'll come back to that I would argue when we talk about the future of libraries, this doesn't get at this. Right? This gets at the collections. This gets at the stuff. But it doesn't get at, can I trust the person who gets me the stuff? And one of the major assets that we all are part of developing, part of the brand that we're developing, is in our trustworthiness. Now, how do we sort of take advantage of this, right? We get Katie Couric getting on and Brian Williams getting in the nightly news and doing articles about library uses exploding. And in the state of Massachusetts, circulation has hit its record year in circulation for the 7th year in a row. So while we can talk about the idea that the recession brought everyone into our libraries, or public libraries at least, because we were like the Walmart of the information world, you know, we were cheap, this has been going on for 20 years, increased usage. So how do we keep it going? Well, you're going to find lots of different thoughts about that, right? There's this group.
Yeah, don't worry, you can't read it. You don't have to. And by the way, this entire slides, and in fact, right, the audio of this are going to be on the website. So, this is a chart where someone took web trends of 2007. They took all the cool websites like Flickr, and like Twitter, and like MySpace, and they mapped it to the Tokyo subway system. Because someone needs more time. Right? And what I love about this is because there's this group out there, the Library 2.0 group, that's pretty sure that this is what's going to be the future of libraries. Oh, those old farts with the collections, and oh, the stacks and ivy, and throw it all away, right? We need to be all massively trustworthy, parallel everything. If you don't blog, you don't exist, and we've got to Facebook this and all that stuff. Right? And so that's an extreme example. Pretty much, you know, this is the Library 2.0 group. So the joke that we have is, can't, after 2,000 years or 3,000 years of history, can't we at least be on Library 12.5 or something? So there's this group. Then there's another group, which is very well represented by this document, that says, oh, stay the course. If what we've been doing is collecting, organizing materials, and cataloging the hell out of it, and we get growth, that's what we need to keep doing. So this is a document which you may or may not have run into, and if you ever want to scare library schools, you can mention it. This is something approved by the ALA Executive Board on core competencies of librarianship, and it's like this massive document that says, thou shalt know the following things. No discussion about why thou shalt know it, just simply thou shalt know. And, you know, there's a group of, Karen Snyder, I've got to be careful. Karen Snyder had a great word for them, bibliofundamentalists, out there, who say that, you know, it's all about cataloging, it's all about this, and this is what librarians should know, and therefore, and there's this nice, you guys have dealt with it, this nice rigidity of the priesthood of librarianship, and then, you know, everyone else who actually makes things work. It's nuts. It's insane. Anyway. You can call, just talk about the priesthood. It's absolutely, it's worth doing. When I do lectures on identity management, really cool, fun stuff like that, I say libraries have two identities in them. They have librarian and not librarian. Right? I mean, and it's not just, you know, library assistants, and it's not just the technical staff. It's like the president of the university counts as a not librarian. Right? If a Nobel laureate walks into your academic library and says, by the way, you've misspelled the following thing, they can't do anything about it. What do they have to do? Go find the librarian who can make the change, who will probably ask not to because now that's the record and we can't mess with a marked record. Anyway, we can just take 2 hours and dish, can't we? All right.
That would be nice.
All right. Then there's this group, right? This group that says the future of libraries are, in fact, Barnes & Noble, right? Gilbert Library in Arizona is the first to drop the Dewey Decimal System, and they're going with publisher cataloging, and they're basically, which is really interesting, and there's everyone showing up at the American Library Association with Dewey and a, you know, line through it and all this wonderful stuff. It's a very small branch library is what it is. And so they don't really deal with how you organize thousands and thousands of things. But there's that group. Now, what's interesting in bringing all this, and I'm going to read this to you so the type's going to be too small, but I want to just give you a quote, and it's deadly in presentations to give quotes, so I'm sorry, but I'm going to do it anyway, that these are challenging, often difficult times for academic libraries. is no news to anyone in the library world. Concern for professionalism with its attention to accountability and responsibility abounds. Unprecedented growth in technology provides vast new opportunities for communication, and the availability of information far outstrips most people's capacity to digest it. In the face of this information explosion, it is ironic that academic librarians are casting about for an appropriate myth or model for library service. While critics charge the academic libraries are not sufficiently integrated into the central concerns of the college or university, and that librarians have their own independent agendas, librarians responsible for present service as well as planning for the future are uneasy. Perhaps it is not an overstatement to say that academic librarians are drifting in a vast sea of information and technological advances, searching for an appropriate course of action. Nevertheless, we appear to have lost our stabilizing rudder or confidence in who we are and what we do. Now, what's interesting, and by the way, I think you could easily take the word academic and throw public or school or special or law or medical. What I find this article terribly interesting by is it was written by Joan Bechtel in College and Research Libraries in May of 1986. And if we go far enough back, we could probably—it's like Socrates talking about kids these days don't get it. We constantly seem to be working for this, and so I actually agree very much with Jones' sentiment here that we need to look at sort of a deeper sense of what we're doing and where we're going. And it may sound like this is terribly esoteric, but what I would tell you is, unless you deal with some of these deeper concepts and roots, you're going to be drifting and dragging in all sorts of different directions. And so here's my sort of preview for the presentation, and I'm going to present it on my abstract-o-meter. As a friend of the Batman franchise in the 60s, the Bat-o abstract-o-meter. Which is, at times, I will be up in the clouds, talking about things that seem like they are completely useless and esoteric, and I'm just, you're going to have to deal with it. But I promise that at times, I'm going to be down here in the gutter, talking about practicalities that are going to scrape your knuckles. And what I'm worried about is, unless you know what the connection is between these two things, or what libraries do, we are going to constantly jump from one gutter to another and never quite understand where we're going. Because, honestly, aren't you tired of jumping from one miracle cure to another? Right? You know, Second Life and MySpace are increasingly the library equivalent of mini skirts and halter tops. It's like this fad of the week. Right? So now it's federated searching. Oh, we just need the one search box on our page and everything will be fine. Oh, it's RFID. We have RFID in our books and self-circulation, life will be better. Oh, and right, you guys get the worst of it. Because it's like, you know, the director sits there and dreams up, oh, it's all about, et cetera. Go make that happen. And so it's a new task force, and of course there's a committee to deal with exactly how it has to happen, and you guys are brought in to make it actually occur, even though you know it might be crazy. So what we need is, this is from the vision statement. If you want to be included actively and meaningful in decisions that affect your life, I would argue that to be involved, you have to be informed and you have to have a plan, and so that's where I'm going to take you today. That's what I'm hoping to do. I'm going to present you with one. And please, pick whatever you need, all right? So, saying I'm going to start in the air, I'm not kidding. You're all familiar with a version of this if you ever went to school, right? And if you remember what these grid lines are, they're longitude and latitude, and you might remember they don't actually exist. You don't trip over these in the jungle, right? You don't, like, walk through Indochina and jump and fall over a red line. What's interesting about that is it came about from a need. They came about from the early developed navies of Western Europe, when they were trying to get all this trade going around the world, and it was faster to go across the water, they could figure out from the stars how north or south they were, latitude. Okay. But the problem was that they could never figure out east-west. And if they ever lost sight of the land, they would get lost in the middle of the ocean. Right? They would literally fall off the edge of the earth, as far as they're concerned. And in fact, that's where we get the term landmark. It's because all the map said, look for that big tree, look for that big hill, look for that, right? It's a landmark. And so they had to stay close to the shore in order not to get lost. But the problem was, there were much more efficient ways to get around the world than that. I would argue that we're pretty much in the equivalent of that right now in library world.
we are looking for landmarks close to the shore to figure out what's next. Now, those landmarks are called Google, and they're called Amazon, and they're called Yahoo, and they're called Twitter, and they're called whatever the latest tech industry pops out. Oh, that must be where we need to go. And so we're constantly running on these waves to try and figure out what's next, as opposed to worried about where we really want to go. Now, the story, by the way, is that eventually someone figured out for a massive amount of money how to go north-south, and that was not to use the stars at all, but to use a really effective clock. And they determined longitude. And in fact, what they managed to do out of this is once they figured out longitude, they could efficiently get from Europe over to North America, they could figure out how to get from North America down to South America, they could really open up the world. Quite literally, these artificial man-made concepts of latitude and longitude, which do not exist in any physical world, they are purely an invention of man, open up the world to them. Just this concept changed the world and made it able for them to move efficiently and effectively across the entire surface of the world. In fact, so effectively that today, we're just talking about trouble getting here, if you use your GPS, you use artificial satellites to use the same system to do this. That's what GPS is based on. That's what GIS is on. Literally an invention from hundreds and hundreds of years ago. What I would argue is we need to develop this time schema and understanding and map of our profession. Because if not, we're going to stuck near the shore. The other part, of course, is if you follow Google or you follow Amazon, you will always be the second best Google or Amazon. Right? Now, I should also point out that worldview matters here because I mentioned I was speaking in Australia. If you're from Australia, this is actually the map that you had in your classroom, and it's not upside down. You look, the words are straight up. Australia got really tired of being at the bottom, and they said, you know, north, south, why pick one? We can flip it around. And in fact, you'll also notice Australia's pretty damn big here, and what we're used to seeing of Greenland being half the map is right here. Right? Because how you take a sphere and make it flat from projection, you can pick like 3,000 of them. And they pick this one, which makes Australia big. If you ever look at this one, can you guess what country figured out who wants to be in the middle of which one and et cetera, right? Australia looking a little tiny down there, Greenland looking huge, all based on worldview. Worldview matters. So what we're going to work on is developing some different worldviews. And I'm going to start at a really basic level. So once again, stick with me, we're in the clouds, but we're coming down quick. What business are libraries in?
Information.
Right? You're not going to like the next question. What is information? By the way, I have a PhD in it, and I can't. But it's an interesting question.
Facts, data.
Facts and data, so you don't have any nonfiction or critical theory or strategy in your life.
You only get about facts and data.
Resources.
Maybe it's reading. Maybe it's literacy. Are we in the same business as Amazon?
Yes.
No. Why not?
Amazon would be an aspect of what we do, but it's not encompass the whole thing. When somebody comes to the library, yes, they want a book, but they would also want internet access. They would also want children's books they don't have to pay for. I mean, Amazon works as a business model. Their thing is to make money.
Right.
If something doesn't make money, they toss it.
We also don't sell rakes and garden equipment, right? But Amazon does.
Well, we could.
We could. Actually, there are many people who loan them out. It's great.
A community library based on a farm.
Right.
And a farm or a farming community may have it.
Right.
But that's interesting.
I don't know whether there is a big difference between Amazon and libraries. They sell information. Libraries better start selling information. So that is very interesting. I'm not quite sure that I'm looking at things a little differently nowadays. I'm not sure that it is different.
Let me throw another one at you. Are we in the same business as Google?
Oh, God.
I don't know. It's information. I think Google is worth it. Google is, I go to Google when I want answers quickly. And libraries now seem to be moving in that direction. They're trying to provide as many databases, as many electronic resources, so people can get the information quick. We have a certain limit at our information desk. We are not supposed to spend more than 5 minutes with each patron. Get them in, get them out, get them the answers, and get them out. I work in a public library. I'm thinking that my thought process is completely different than where it was 10 years ago.
All right. How about one more? Are we the same business as Sears?
Yes.
Okay. Why?
I agree. And somebody said business model. I don't know if it was that gentleman or if it was you. I think that it's important that libraries start to function more as businesses to be more effective, to meet people's needs. That people are looking at libraries now the same way they are looking at Amazon or Google. They expect the same kind of information, data, product.
Sears. You have a help desk, right? Your toaster breaks, you call them up.
Sears is known for quality service.
Quality service.
Like that. Yeah.
All right. Business model is interesting. Amazon, yeah, it's in a money thing business. Google is the world's largest advertising agency. Everything they do is to get eyes to sell ads. Sears is in the thing business where they sell merchandise and customer service. If we constantly look at the surface aspects of these, which is going right along that shore and looking for those near landmarks, it is really easy to see similarities with what we do. And the problem is for libraries, for a long time, we spent a lot of time looking at those landmarks, worrying about them greatly. Right? We're afraid of things that seem to be in our business. Things that look like what we are. And I, by the way, am all for and think competition is vitally important. I want to be really clear. I think we actually need a little bit more competition in what we do. But I would argue that, in fact, one of the major differences is that while Amazon's in the selling things business, and we're going to see that a little bit more, and Sears is, and Google's in the money business and advertising business, I would argue that we're not in the information business at all. I would argue that we are in something much more fundamental. And knowledge is different than information, because I can define what knowledge means. In fact, let me do it right now. Thank you. So obviously, we're not in the spelling business. All right. Let's take Bob. This is Bob.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Bob. Bob's got a question. It's represented by a hole in Bob's head. Now, the reason I'm going to start with Bob is you probably have heard the phrase about being user-oriented or customer-oriented or patron-oriented or whatever. Actually, Joan Fry Williams had the best phrase when this library was dealing with what do we call the people who come in and use us? Do we call them users? Great line. Only people who have users are computer scientists and drug dealers, right? Do we call them patrons because they perambulate into our room? And she went out and she said, well, let's ask them. And they all almost universally said, we're members. We have cards. We have privileges. We are members. We are part of this organization. So let's say Bob is a member here. All right? So we're going to start with Bob's question. Bob has a question. And Bob needs to get an answer. Now, where did that question come from? That question came from two places. First, it came from Bob already knowing some stuff. Think about this as previous knowledge. And Bob has run into a situation where he's found a gap in that knowledge. He needs to do something, know something, say something, but he can't. And either he needs to do something or say something because he's intrinsically motivated or extrinsically motivated. Big fancy terms that only mean either someone told him to find out or he had to find out himself. Right? So I was redoing our kitchen and we had to take tile out. We're going to put new tile in. And I said, tile, how hard can that be? Hammer, tile, go. Right? It worked beautifully. Until I realized that if you're in the tiling business or in the drywall business, because pretty soon I'm like touching the outside of my house and going, this is not a good thing. And either I can pay someone to come in and drywall my kitchen or I can find out myself and save a lot of money. So I was very intrinsically motivated to figure this out. Right? If you're in an academic environment, you're used to a lot of extrinsically motivated students. I got a paper. It's due tomorrow. Right? Reference librarians, we have the secret torture activity we have, right? It's the English Composition 101, where we know exactly what the assignment is. We know exactly the resources we need. We, in fact, have them right behind the desk. And the student comes in, and we still run them through the little game. How can I help you?
I got a paper.
Oh, and what is your paper on? Meanwhile, like, you're done, right? You do this game. So, libraries love to think we're in the intrinsically motivated business. In public libraries, we revel in intrinsic motivation, the love of reading. I'm like the only one in the library field who hates the phrase, the love of reading. I like the necessity of reading. If you don't read, you're screwed. All the, you know, you don't talk about the love and joy of mathematics. So, anyway. So Bob's got a problem. Bob's got a problem. He's got a gap. This is how we're going for the rest of the day, folks. So, you know. What's Bob going to do? Well, Bob is going to explore a domain of knowledge. He's going to go figure out what he doesn't know. And he's going to do it over time. And as Bob is exploring this topic over time, Bob's knowledge, how he knows the world, is going to change. One of the things that I think we often don't think about, the difference between the information business and the knowledge business, is change. We're in the change business. We're in the education business. Our job is to change how people view the world. Not maybe that much, right? Gee, I didn't know Brittany shaved her head this day. Or it might be this much. Gee, I never thought I could go get a college career, or I could go and do all these wonderful things, etc. But it's change business. Now, how is Bob going to explore this? Well, Bob is going to engage in a series of conversations. Because knowledge is created through conversations. Now, some of these conversations are going to be with buddies and friends. Some of these are going to be with you and the library staff. Most of the conversation, the overwhelming number, is going to be with Bob himself. Right? Now, this is really, yeah, I know you're sitting looking at me going, patrons talking to themselves, not a good thing. Right? But we do it all the time. If you just in your head said, what the hell is he talking about? Who were you talking to? Right? When you're reading a book, you are not having a conversation with the author. It's not like William Shakespeare sitting on the other end going, no, I didn't even understand what I wrote at that point, right? It's yourself you're having a conversation with. And so as Bob goes through the world, he's going to have these conversations, and he's going to arrive at a series of agreements. Now, what's an agreement? We could call them facts, but sometimes they're not facts at all. Sometimes they're opinions. Sometimes they're very strongly held opinions. Sometimes they're perspectives. Sometimes they're examples. Right? And so what an agreement constitutes is something. It's hot. It's sunny. It's rainy. 2 + 2 = 4. Healthcare, good. Health, whatever it is. That agreement probably might have some connection to an artifact. I read it in this book. I read it in here. And it may well have a connection to the conversant that you were talking about. When we were talking, and remember we said, yeah. Now we know from lots of psychology studies that that agreement is going to stay a lot longer than you're remembering where you found it out. It's called source amnesia. And you have it on a regular basis. Right? This is when you're having an argument. You're like, I read this article and it was like, you know, really cool. I have no idea what it was, right? You know, or you're like as senile as I am. You run into someone and you're like, oh, I have this great story, and you, yeah, I told it to you. Yeah, that's right. Okay, so right, you got these things, right? So really, that agreement is what stays with us. And if you look at things like psychology literature, you look at in the election, right, with all the misinformation that goes around. There's this wonderful set of psychology that says if someone comes up with a lie about you. Someone comes up with some misinformation about you, the worst thing you can do is start by saying, here's what the lie is and it's wrong. Because by saying, here's what the lie is, you're actually reinforcing in the head, hearing that over and over again. In fact, you become the source. He said it was a liar. No, I said, but here's, right? So the idea is these agreements stick. Now, over time, we're going to lose connection to what those agreements are, but we're going to stick with it. The other thing you should know about it, as you get to know this domain and topic, you don't get to know these sort of isolated facts on your own. They're not like these little buckets. In fact, if you look at how libraries are organized, it's exactly how your brain is not organized. You say, what? You don't think about the world as, you know, this is where biology stuff sits, and this is where nonfiction sits. I mean, it's all in your head. In jumbled up. I'm going to prove it to you. I'm going to give you a word. Formula. Think about what that word means. Take a second. What does the word formula mean? All right, interactive portion of our type. How many people thought chemical combination? How many people thought mathematical expression? How many people thought baby food? Okay. New parents, grandparents, now, what if I did this? What if I said formula? Well, it's a chemical combination. Right? Now, I'll give you another one. Light. Ready? How many people thought illumination? How many people thought set a fire? Good, good. No pyros in the room. How many people thought not heavy? Right? Now, what if I did this? Now, what's interesting,
in 5 years, if I do this to a middle school class, I'll have no idea what that is. Right? No, it doesn't look like a twirly thing that I used to have for ice cream. Right?
Now, what's going on here? Well, I'll explain really clearly. How about this one?
Oh right.
I'm going to guess no one thought object management group, Omnicom media group, right? It's, oh, my God, right? And, in fact, you can even predict the picture that's going to be shown, right? Why?
Well, think about it. You have the word, when you encounter the word formula, you've encountered it as, well, I had to take a chemistry class to remember a formula. Oh, I had to remember a formula for this exam I took. Or, oh, what was the formula, right? You've dealt with them all. And they're all sort of equal. And so your brain just sort of picks one. But the minute I give you a picture, your brain goes, it picks the one it wants. Because it's got a bunch of relationships in your mind. Same thing with light. All those make sense. But when you see this, you have a very strong connection, but a very limited number of connections. So, for example, when I put the slide together, people said, oh, texting, it's a phone. And now people say, no, it's IM, it's instant messaging. But it's two to pick from, right? As opposed to hundreds to pick from. This is, by the way, why humor works. Is you get, so here's my children teach me all my jokes, so I apologize for how they are. Knock, knock. Hey, interrupting cow. Moo! Okay? Now, why is that vaguely funny? Why that's vaguely funny is it makes sense. Interrupting, oh, I get it. And it's a cow, oh, that's right. So you can see the connections there. As opposed to when my six-year-old tells a joke. Knock, knock, who's there? Interrupting cow. Interrupting cow who? Interrupting cow and the chicken fly go. He doesn't get that there's a pattern in the next thing. Humor is, put someone in a pattern, change the ending. Which is not illogical and crazy, but not what you expected. Right? And so, that. And by the way, that's why you can never remember a good joke. There's a great article in the New York Times a few weeks ago. Your brain seeks patterns. It's trying to limit those things. And so when you take it down a road, your brain is going, alright, I'm going to get this, now I'm going to get this, now I'm going to... And a joke, they twist at the end. Your brain's not set up to deal with the twist. It finds it funny, but it doesn't know how to store it back in your memory. So when you hear a good joke, oh, that was a great joke, but I can't remember it, because your brain is used to looking for a pattern, and a joke is not a pattern. In fact, it specifically breaks it. Now, we can combine these concepts together. Formula plus light plus, oh my God, equals fireworks, right? The formula for fireworks produces light, right? Or how about this one? Clearly, you were thinking about the great coffee cakes instead of sticky buns recipe, right? Or this one. Right? Makes sense. But when you're used to in library land, this is not the connections that we anticipate. Your brain is wired to think about interrelations and connections and relationships. This is how you learn. This is why if you ever went to a history class, you probably hated the fact that it was taught in 18 this, in 1900 this, and this. And if you ever lucked into one of those teachers who tells you stories that wind around and all that, that's because your brain's looking for the narrative. It's looking for the connections.
Now, I'll let you go ahead and fill this one in for yourself.
But think about this in terms of artifacts, right? I don't know what the joke was. Alright, if we take something like, this is the Gutenberg Bible, right? The Gutenberg Bible, some people look at this thing, this artifact, and they say, oh,
That's the origin of printing. Everyone knows Gutenberg, printing, right? Or some people look at it and say, no, that's a very valuable book. That's something we've got to worry about preserving. And some people look at this as, no, that's the Word of God. That must be what's obeyed. Now, what's interesting about all of these is you may have all of these or part of these or some of these, but none of these come from this thing. Right? It's all about what we bring to the thing. So, let's see if I have it. Yeah. Right? It's the user, that Bob, looking at this thing, defines the context of it. Not you, not the library. So you can go ahead and put it on whatever shelf you want. The user may look at this, and they may look at things like, once again, why is this book in fiction when clearly this is the truth? You know, or why is this in biology when really it's politics, etc.? Because when you're in the knowledge business, things are a little bit more complicated than when you're in the thing business or the information business. So this is the worst phrase ever that our field has, called recorded knowledge.
We're in the business of recorded knowledge.
And when you read those ALA's core requirements, they're all about recorded knowledge. We further the human record. We further human knowledge. This is a rock. This happens to be a rock outside of Frank Lloyd Wright's camp in Phoenix, Arizona. And when I look at it, I see a rock. But the truth is, if you'll notice these ideograms on it, these are Native American ideograms. So an archaeologist can look at that, and they see meaning. They see writing. A geologist can look at this rock, and they can see the history of what happened in origin. But it's not in the rock that knowledge resides. It is in my head where that knowledge resides. And when it resides in my head and your head, it's radically different than the neighbor sitting next to you. And while we can have conversations trying to get it really close as to what those agreements are, can we agree that this is a rock? Yes. No, it's not a rock. It's a vital artifact that much, right? We have these discussions, these conversations, where we come to knowledge. Right? So we've got Bob here now, who's gone through this process and built this web of knowledge, and now we can start talking about, all right, if this is how we learn, if this is how human beings understand the world, what impact does this have on libraries? How does this help us get away from those landmarks? How does this help us determine when the next thing comes out? So we're twittering today, and we'll be zipping tomorrow, and we'll be, but how can we determine which one to jump on? How many people since your library jumped into Second Life? Anyone? You have a Second Life site?
In our library.
You and your
library. We have courses.
Right. And if you took courses in library, you know, 3 years ago, you were probably hearing about Second Life. No one talks about Second Life. It was going to be the origin. So how can we keep from jumping from thing to thing to thing? By the way, if you go back, I don't want to just pick on modern technology. If you were around in the 70s, we were going to have libraries in suitcases. And it was all going to be microfiche. We're going to have little microfiche readers, and we could walk around with all the collections and have our, right? So we're going to walk around with our libraries and microfiche readers. Right? Someone once said libraries are like, you know, the graveyard of technological promise. We just, you know, what gen jump on? So let's talk about, first of all, we know that when Bob here is doing this, Bob is doing this in a digital environment. Bob is doing this in a physical environment, talking to friends, experimenting, trying things in your physical library, and hybrid environments, like you have to come to the library to search that database kind of stuff.
Can I ask a question?
Please.
Isn't it our job as a library, I work in a public library,
yep,
to provide these cutting-edge trends to see if they take off or not?
Ah, now that's a great question. Is it the library's role to try out these technologies and provide access to these technologies to see if they take off? And I think the answer is absolutely yes. But that's different than saying, we think that this is the future of libraries. That's saying the role of libraries is experimentation, discovery, building new knowledge about technologies. I agree with that 100%. A lot of the times what we see is, this is the technology that we can cram our existing way of doing things into. So for example, Facebook. A lot of libraries talk about using Facebook to attract users. Now, there's two things that are interesting. Is if you look at why people use Facebook, by the way, this is why people use Facebook, because you can construct your world, right? You can invite your friends in. You can make it look, you can add your applications in.
And be selective about what you put there.
Right. And so when you look at why Wikipedia goes crazy and Microsoft is now actually canceling Encarta, right? Because when I go to Wikipedia, I can see who I want to talk to, and I can construct the world if I want to, right? It gives me the ability of making my own relationships as opposed to having to learn someone else's, right? So Facebook makes a lot of sense. Then when you look at the library, you begin to ask things like, has anyone heard the phrase creepy treehouse? My favorite phrase is this. Creepy treehouse. Imagine that a father builds a treehouse for his sons, and he has such a good time building it that he never wants to leave the treehouse. And the sons don't want to hang out in a treehouse with their dad because it's creepy, right? What has come to mean in technology is when adults come into children's spaces to help them, like friending your mom. In okay, that's a little creepy treehouse, right? You know, I don't want my mom to see my mind safely. Right? So that's one. The other is I talked to lots of librarians who are like, yeah, we finally figured out how to get out of the anti-spamming thing because what they were doing is going look at everyone's walls, friending them. And then when they posted questions or something, the librarian would come in and do reference, sort of in-your-face reference work. And Facebook kept saying, no, this is called spam. You can't just unsolicited begin adding in. And so the libraries didn't understand why they kept getting kicked off. And so one thing is to say, are we helping people understand how this technology is, what it's good for, how they can improve their lives with it? Brilliant. How can we build knowledge of our community to make intelligent decisions about technology? The other is, oh, we're going to take what we do about organizing information and putting it in slots. We're going to figure out how to jam it into Facebook because that's another interface. So I think absolutely it's a role. But that's another thing, which is when does one of the questions that every organization, not just libraries, every organization has a really hard time answering is when to stop. When do you cut it? When do you kill it? Right? When do you say this experiment failed? Or this experiment's great and should be adopted? Right? When can we say that the web, for example, is worth keeping doing, but Gopher is not, if you go back that far?
Oh, yeah.
Right? Telnet. What's that?
Telnet.
And high Telnet to connect your Telnets together. Right? When do we give them up? Well, a lot of times, if all we're doing is jumping from the next one to the next one, and if we're assuming that Google knows why we're doing this, we'll just keep doing it until they stop, then we can't answer our own resource questions. So, great question. And great conversation. All right. So one of the things that we wanted to look at is in this environment, what can the library do in this environment? Because this is how people learn. So they're going to do this in schools. They're going to do this in their everyday life. They're going to do this about things we don't care about. Right? One of the real questions between Amazon, Google, and Sears is what's the difference between a library and this thing, whether it's K-12 or higher education or community college or what have you. That's a real interesting question. No, we'll do it. Just pick on doing a little bit more. Look at the public library as a co-equal educational institution to the public schools. So we are in the same business. We are equal in that business. We simply don't deal with established curriculum. We deal with discovery learning.
There's limits on what you learn in school. And in a library, there really isn't.
Right. So one could say, for example, one of the major differences is this emphasis on motivation. Intrinsic motivation versus extrinsic motivation, right? School is primarily extrinsically. This is what society thinks you need to know, and these are mostly intrinsically. How do we discover it? That's one. And in fact, there's lots of organizations. The MacArthur Foundation has a big established initiative to learn about digital youth and learning. And what they found is No Child Left Behind is making schools impossible to change how we educate children, so we're just going to give up and go to the next thing. And what did they find? Libraries and museums. Because they're established, they could reach them, but they don't have these built-in structures. But then again, of course, we run into little things like COPPA and SEPA and filtering and E-rate and all that other stuff in which legislatures don't necessarily agree that we're radically different. So, interesting things to write.
But not all library sponsors.
That's correct. And not all libraries take federal funding. All right. So let's talk a little bit about what libraries can do in this space. So I told you, now we're coming out of the air. Let's sprinkle down to something very specific. If this is how we learn, how can libraries respond to it? Well, one of the questions is how do we get from that dot to that dot? How does someone who's sort of groping through the space know where to get next? So here's my story. That, you know, today, I knew that I was presenting in Troy, New York, and I knew I was presenting at Sage College. And so I drove to Sage College, and I realized then I didn't quite have the full picture. For example, parking, no idea. So I'm parked somewhere, And luckily I have GPS on my phone, so I'll find it again. And I follow the sign, which was great. It got me over to a building over there that said reception for this lot. And but it said, it's okay, we'll be in the Aggie. So I walked over, and luckily there was someone who said, oh, the Aggie's that building. And so I went in, and sure enough, in the Aggie building, there was somebody who said, you know, by the way, how would you pronounce? I don't want to mispronounce.
Nysla.
Okay. I went to Nysla. By the way, I ask that because sometimes, you know, you keep the words, don't, like, there's a Western New York Library Council, which is the Winnie Lurk. I mean, by God, they're going to pronounce every consonant in their name. And there's a sign in the Aggie which has nice little arrows pointing down, 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 which goes to a reception, which was cool, except none of you were there. And I said, what are you guys setting up for? I don't mean to pick on the organizers. Sorry.
We're so sorry it happened.
No, I'm here. But so they said, no, they're probably in whatever this building is. And sure enough, someone was having lunch. Thank you very much. And you said, oh, you're upstairs.
Thank you.
So,
thank you.
Right? But it's not a problem. I'm here, right? The point is, the line, how do you get from dot to dot and line to line? But here's the other thing. You guys were set up. This system was set up perfectly for people here yesterday where you sort of walked me through all this, is my guess, right? You gave them this room assignment. So,
and we were just closed for lunchtime. That was why there was nobody there. You just happened to come at the lunchtime. Nobody was there.
But that's my point. When you look at libraries and how they're organized, we have to pick. When you have a physical book, a physical thing has to go in one place or the other. You have to pick. Right? And so people at the Philadelphia Free Library in their Science and Industry building, were, you know what they were most annoyed about? That they had to have cookbooks in Science and Industry. Why do they have cookbooks in Science and Industry? Pop quiz. Dewey Decimal System has cookery as home economics, which is a form of Science and Industry, so therefore cookbooks go right next to all the business books and the Moody database and such. By the way, it's not a shelf list, so they're not going there. Right? So in a physical world, we pick. Imagine if I gave you a task, and I said, all right, what I want you to do is walk into Grand Central Station, New York City, rush hour. And I want you to bring me back a list of every conversation going on in that big grand space. What would you do? Well, probably.
Or before 4 o'clock in the morning.
I want rush hour. You could say, everybody stop. Everyone having business conversations over here, everyone personal conversations here, business, I want medical here. You begin subdividing them into small enough categories that when they're small enough groups, you can go, yeah, what were you talking about? What were you talking about? In a physical space, you don't have too many other options. But right now, as we speak, thousands upon thousands of conversations are co-occurring in this room. And it's not just in your heads and such. Radio waves are going through. And if you have a piece of technology, you can tune into the conversation you care about. Right? There are phone calls going on about what we're going to do on Friday night. Where is this going on? Right? Radio waves and all that. But given the right technology, they don't interfere with each other. In fact, if you come in, you can radio, you can pick out which channel you want on the frequency, you can even co-locate them with your buttons and all this other stuff. Given the right technology, we don't have to come up with just one way of organizing the world. That's one of the main, how many people remember when the early websites had Dewey Decimal classifications to web pages? Right? And now we go, there's so many. What do you mean? You're going to have a 100-level web page? And it doesn't make any sense. Google came through and said, no, there's a whole new way. What we're going to do is rather than come up with topic organization, we're going to see who links to whom and who links to that. That's how we're going to organize the web. And even then, there are drawbacks, right? Things that are more popular come to the top. Things that are less popular come to the bottom. So each way of organizing it has pluses and minuses. That's where things like MySpace and Facebook come in. I can organize it the way I want. So one of the things that we looked at, I was working with the Free Library of Philadelphia, and we started talking about creating topical centers. And so the idea was we went to the business community. We said, all right, business community of Philadelphia, what do you want in your public library? And the business community of Philadelphia looked at us and they said, nothing. We don't care about that. I said, really? We're Shell Corporation. We've got a library downstairs. Right? But when I was starting my business, a library was invaluable.
you know, I was working at this major corporation. I had a great idea, but I couldn't use company resources to do it. So where did I go? To the public library. Had the resources, it had the space, it had a quiet place to work. So really, major business corporations, we don't see the Philadelphia Free Library helping us specifically, but entrepreneurship, that's the place to do it.
And they said, now the other trick is when I was starting out as a small business, the last thing I needed was a book on starting business X, Y, or Z, because as an entrepreneur, I was making a new business. Right? There wasn't a book written about how to start my business. There are plenty of books about how to start a business, or butcher business, or business. But what I really need is, I needed to do a business plan. I had no idea what a business plan was. I really needed to find an accountant. I don't know how to find an accountant. I needed to worry about regulation. I'm not a lawyer. So what I needed was a place that would help me walk through that process, that in essence had a curriculum. Now, I could go get an MBA if I had a lot of money. But the truth is, I need a little start and a little access. I need a place to do it. I'm a single mother or a single father. I need daycare for my kids so I have time to concentrate on what I'm talking about. And what they said is, what this business center should look like is it should look like this. The public library for entrepreneurs should look like this. I want a place to go in that's going to take me on field trips to successful business. It's going to set me up with venture capitalists and bankers to give me my loans. That are going to let me put the business plan together and store it on your computer. It's going to take me basic literacy courses like how to put PowerPoint together for the pitch. That's what I need. We then talked to the musicians, and we said, all right, musicians of Philadelphia, what do you need? And they said, you know what we really need? You got CDs, that's great. You got archives, all this other stuff. They said, the first thing is, if I'm a popular musician, country, pop, whatever, I don't need you at all. It's going on the club scenes, going on all these places. But if I'm into classical music or world music, nothing. There's no way to connect. There's no place for it. And the number one thing we need is we need two grand pianos on a stage.
And we all looked at it and said, what?
And they said, the number one piece of street credibility you can get as a musician is performance. Has your piece been performed? And in central Philadelphia, there wasn't enough places to perform in. The other thing they said is, even if you want to do the simple reference kind of stuff where I'm looking up a piece of music to play or something, if I get a piece of music and I go, it's not as good as sitting down and actually playing it. Because the language that we exchange between musicians, have you thought about this, is actually music. And so we need a way to reproduce that. And what's interesting is, if we come and perform, the performance is what we care about. We're just thrilled if you record it and make it available to people and podcast it out to the world. In fact, that helps us. We're thrilled if you want to do electro music appreciation ahead of time. That helps us. And so what they began doing was saying, Philadelphia is going to be, the free library is going to be a place where other people from outside Philadelphia come to learn about music in Philadelphia, not the other way around. All too often, libraries serve like this, which is we assume the answer is outside of you. We assume that the information you need is not within our own organization. So in the academic library, we buy books and articles from other people. And yet we have dissertations that we keep down on microfiche over here. In the public library, we buy, there's a local history collection, but most of it is other reading from other places. Well, what about coming to your library to learn about your community and your organizations? What you need. Okay. So one thing that we looked at was, how do you build these topical centers to teach people to go from one point to another? Because it's all about this and not about things. I don't want a book. I want an answer. I don't want a reading list. I want a plan. Right? I want to do something. Now, what about the people who want a book and a good reading? Great. If that's what your community cares about. Lemoyne, I'll pick on Lemoyne here in Syracuse. You guys have a pretty big popular media collection. Movies and such. Because, frankly, I've been to Lemoyne. There's not a, within walking distance, there's not a Blockbuster kind of stuff. And it kind of makes sense that you serve as a bit of a public library function within it, even though you have a branch across the street. But we don't talk about it. Syracuse University is the same way, right? Many universities are little islands where what we need to do is provide people with more than just what they need to learn. We need other things. But that's a community conversation, a community discussion. Now, I'm going to run through a real quick piece of software about getting specific. Are we doing okay? I'm just throwing an arm, but you want questions? All right. Questions, comments? Anyone want a mint? Okay. Remember what I said about things being thing-based? Is if the world looks like this, relationships, connections, and all that, why do I keep breaking up on things? Well, let me give you an example. Let's say I'm interested in Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, right? Pick a boring old book. If I look this up... Well, but if I look this book up in the OCLC's Open World Chat, that's the entirety of the information stored on that book. Right? You can read it at your leisure. Okay? If I look at it in the Onondaga County Public Library, that's the amount of information. This is the full screen, not just what's above the full screen. By the way, I know you can't read it, but I bet you can guess it. Anyone know what this deep block is right here that's half the page? Nope. Holdings. It's at this branch, it's at this branch, it's at this branch.
Yeah.
National Library of Australia, Library of Congress. Now, how many of you have been on the Website Sucks Committee? Our website sucks. We need a new website. Right? It always comes down to, it sucks. It's too hard. It's too complicated. I don't like the color blue. And then somewhere in that conversation, it needs to be easier, simpler. It needs to be like Google. It needs to be like Amazon. Because Amazon, no one scrolls down. Ready?
Isn't that funny? We just
had the same conversation.
We designed our website for the first time in 3 months.
Same book, Amazon. Simpler, easier. One page. People don't scroll. What's going on here? Well, if you look at it, oh, it's all marketing crap. No, it's not. That itty-bitty blue line up there, that's navigation and menu. That says Amazon and click on books and garden rakes. The next one is sales information, how much it's going to cost you, who the author is. Then we have some recommendations. If you like this book, you'll like that other one. Quality reviews, New York Times book reviews. Bibliographic data. Now, what's interesting is if you add this and this up, you're probably exactly where these are. They're item stuff. It's things about the things. Okay? What else is on here? Recommendation based on other purchasing. Open reviews. People talking about stuff. Pathfinders. If you like this, you'll like that. Here's reading lists. Discussion tools. Video blogs and such. And at the bottom, some more marketing information. But what you're seeing is conversations. And what's really interesting, what Amazon hasn't figured out, is that people don't care about things. This is all about the thing. But Harry Potter's not a thing. Right? When I said a stupid book, or a silly book, or whatever I said, that's a qualified statement. No, a boring book, right? No, it's an exciting book, right? We're qualifying. We're not talking about the book anymore. We're actually talking about our reaction to the book. And in fact, if you read these open reviews, just pick one. If you pick a book, and you watch the reviews, and then pick one in a series, 75 to 85% of the comments are not about that book. In this one, for example, you'll see a discussion that says, oh, J.K. Rowling was an awesome author. I had no idea the kinds of things he was just throwing in to book one wouldn't become really important to book six. Are they talking about book one? Or are they talking about book six? Right? They're talking about all of them. Or, if you like this book, you'd love this book. Or you should read this book. But because Amazon is in the thing business, it wants to sell this book, it crams all of that into this discussion. And what's interesting is they do it in a stupid way. The stupid way is they just treat them as big blobs of text. So there's one if you do sleep parenting guides to sleep habits of infants, he says, because he dearly spent a lot of time looking at this one. I found this great book, right? So that it said, if you like this book, you'll also like this book. Right? People, right? But it turns out that if you read the comments, like, I cannot believe Amazon put these two books together because they're exactly the opposite approach, right? One is, let the kid cry, he'll deal with it, right? And the other is, oh, cuddle that little precious until he gets out of your bed at 36, whatever it is, right? But because Amazon, it says, oh, we're cheating this thing, and this thing is related to this thing because people looked at both, they said, these are related. No, they're not. Right? Or, what's more like this? If I ask for more like this, what am I going to get? Because you say, oh, we're going to do more juvenile fiction. We're going to give you more magic stuff. Well, when I look at Harry Potter, you know what Harry Potter is to me? It's something I used to bond with my first son. And so if I were to look for more books like this, I would get, in my mind, I would get Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, The Complete Guide to Vehicles for Star Wars. I would get, what's the recent one? Diary of a Wimpy Kid. Right, there are things that got my son excited about reading. Not, well, this is what Dewey says they're like, or Library of Congress is like. Our catalogs do the same thing that Amazon does, which is we assume that that knowledge, that importance, that meaning, that understanding is in the things, but it's not. You guys, if you've ever sat on a reference desk, you've seen it happen. Someone asks you a question in one word, and the answer is completely in another universe. Right? I once, there's a great phrase, Sarah Weissman once said, reference interview is putting the patron on a rack until they tell you the truth. Right? So I walk up to the desk and I say, I'm interested in books on nutrition. Well, what kind of books on nutrition? I'm interested in books on how I can eat less nutrition. Right? Because, you know, I want the diet books, but, you know, I'm because reference is an unnatural act. Right? It's walking up to a complete stranger and saying, hello, I'm ignorant. Right? This is not something you do on a regular basis. By the way, if you're ever bored, YouTube has a great thing. It's called Real Life Twitter. And it's just this guy walking around New York City as if he were twittering things. It's like, I'm bored. I think I'm going to, you know, people look at him strange. You know, it's like, I'm sitting next to the most beautiful woman, but I don't have the courage to say anything. Anyway. So what can we do? What should our systems look like instead of this? Catalogs are not knowledge systems. They are inventory systems.
Can I throw something in? Please. People love Amazon.
Absolutely.
Love they do. It.
You know what else they love? Library thing.
Yes, they do.
But they're different. It's in, no, people do. I love Amazon. How many people, and I'll be the first to raise my hand, go to Amazon to find a book and then see if it's in your library? Right? Why is that? Because all this data is useful and good. I'm not saying this is evil and bad, but I'm saying it's really interesting that they're not taking advantage of some of the data they have. Right?
They, who do you mean?
I mean Amazon.
Okay.
We don't even gather the data because, God forbid, a user may give us private information. We never wanted that to know what they checked out last month.
Ah!
I mean, come on, guys. It's as if we believe that the FBI is literally sitting outside of our door waiting to send us Patriot Act requests. And come on. These are inventory systems. Some of them are better inventory systems. By the way, the major difference, Amazon doesn't care what the holdings are because they're dealing with them as commodities. Right? They don't need to tell you where they are because they're in our warehouse. You're just going to get them. They're also treating them as generic items.
And if they don't have it for you, they don't get it.
Right. So, but their inventory system, now you have, an inventory system is when you go in and you're shopping for a shoe and you're going, do you have this in a size 8? And it's what the person working there will, like, walk behind the desk and hide as they click on this little terminal, which probably is black with green text on it. Right? That's the inventory system. Yes, we do, but it's in... What do we do with that system? I don't know. Do we? And we just turn around, hand to the user, and assume it's going to work. Right? This is insane. Inventory systems are vitally important to the business of libraries. There are our tools. They're crap for knowledge discovery. They are. If you look at it, you look at all the evaluations of catalogs, if you put a librarian in front of a catalog and it almost doesn't matter which one, they perform brilliantly with it. Right? You put it in front of a user, and the user walks away and goes, what's this crap?
Yeah.
Why?
Exactly.
Yeah. Who built the catalog? Who did they build it for? Who thinks like them? Them! I once got...
I'd like you to come and speak in our library.
I once got really evil looks at one point because I got up in front of a LEDA conference and said, we need to stop having next generation cataloging questions and make this the last generation of catalogs. People were, no, we have tagging. All right, let's take a moment for tagging. All right. This is what we try and do with our frickin' catalogs, which is, we'll fix them. How? Not by blowing them up. No, that would be too simple. We'll do, here's the ugly, stupid thing you can't find to begin with, but we'll make it easy on you. We'll let you add tags. All right. Do this experiment for yourself. Pick something randomly, preferably something obscure like this, where we're not quite sure what it is. Write down 10 tags.
Oh, my gosh.
Give it to a friend in the next office who's never seen this and ask them to identify what they're talking about. Then, after they can't do that, take your list and hide it from yourself for 6 months. Look at the list and see if you can find out what you were describing. Tags are disconnected pieces of information. They're not stories. In essence, tags like teaching history. This is what happened in 1872. They're very current. And it turns out when you aggregate them, like in Flickr, they can do cool things. Primarily, we go back to our language use because we tend to use the same words for the same ideas. But search for baby, right? And you're always going to get young infants. Oh, my baby. You know, it's a picture of a Camaro, whatever it is. Right? Tagging doesn't work because it's not connected. It's a set of discrete pieces of information. All right. So what should an information system look like? What kind of system should we be building? Well, I would argue they should look like this. And that's not kidding. All right. I'll give you three icons. What we're going to do is we're going to take an information problem solving, and it's going to be, I admit, trivial. I'm driving through the, driving in my car on the way here today, and I hear a song. Gwen Stefani song, Rich Girl. And it's reminding me of something. And I know I've heard from somewhere, but I don't know what it is. So I'm going to figure it out. So we call this escape. So I'm going to start by a simple search, typing in the word Rich Girl. Okay? And up pops a bunch of stuff, and we're going to talk about where that comes later. But there it is. It's an MP3 file. I drag that over, and sure enough. I know I've heard that somewhere before, right? Yeah, don't jump ahead! This is a highly orchestrated and choreographed lesson! Proving the point, once again, you know, you guys know more than me. But anyway, now, what I can do with this in sort of a traditional way is I can click on it and get a bunch of bibliographic data, sort of the stuff libraries are used to capturing about. Who the artist was, who the album was, what the release date was. And with a simple set of clicks, I can create a relationship that says, this song came from that album. Clearly not helping me, right? It's not. My question is, where did this come from? So I'm going to bring in a buddy. Now, I used this example in a book I was writing about reference, and I got this rather snooty response back from the reviewer that said, he doesn't bring a reference librarian into, like, the end. Yeah. It's like watching my 9-year-old wake up and go, is it sunny out today? I'll make a call to the librarian. So I'm going to bring in a buddy. I'm going to bring in my friend Jeff, and I'm going to start saying, hey, Jeff, do you know where I can find the lyrics for this song? He goes, hold on. He uses the same interface that I have. We're seeing this simultaneously, right? If any of you guys play with virtual reference, last time I came to talk to NIFLA was a couple years ago, we were having virtual reference systems, right? Where the reference librarians have the better tools than the patrons, right? They come in and they just get fed scripts, but the reference librarians have the power to disconnect them and things like that. Right, but we're using the same tools, the same toys, and he says, you know what? Here it is. I found someone who did an escape of this. In other words, one of these connected worlds. I'll bring it in. He creates a connection there, and I can look at it, and sure enough, there's the lyrics. But this is, once again, one of those sort of related sets of information. What this person has done is they've gone ahead and called out some of the weird lyrics in here already. So, In My Galley Out of Gown, Clean Out Vivian Westwood, See Stefani and Her Lamb, I Rock the Fetish, or my favorite, I Get Me for Hayuka Girl to Right? And what's nice is they've even taken that further so that I can find out that Hayuka girls are actually her backup dancers, and they're named after a fashionable subway stop in Tokyo. Now you know. Okay? So, I've created those connections, but still not getting me where I want to go, and so I'm going to go ahead, now I'm going to bring in a reference librarian, and I'm going to say, Hi, do you know if this song is a remake? In essence, I'm going to ask the right question now. And the rapper Siren is going to say, actually, it's a remake of Fiddler on the Roof. And, in fact, I'll go ahead and add that information. And with simple tools that we can all see and participate together with, she can go ahead and add the fact that it's a remake of this song. It's from this The Power Rich Man from Fiddler on the Roof. And here's all the information. Right? Now, what's interesting is, imagine if I were working on this, and now I called in one of you guys, someone working at the reference desk, and I said, I had the question. Rather than you having to start from scratch about, number one, most insulting reference question ever, have you checked Google? Yeah, that's why I'm here, right?
that was going to be my first question to you. Wouldn't it be simpler?
Just go to Google.
Type in Gwen Stefani,
remake.
Rich Girl,
right.
And remake, and boom.
Yeah, and for many cases you are, right? This is a trivial example. But we're working, for example, on looking at this medical applications, right? You've just been diagnosed with something, my favorite are syndromes, right? Syndromes are things where we have no idea what they are, but we've given them a name, right? In which case, increasingly, you're on your own with trying to find the information. So you can find lots of stuff in Google and such that may agree or disagree. But if you can begin to map that out, oh, this stuff's taking this position, this stuff's taking that position, and now I can... So, yes, I'm going to use search Google, I'm going to search all these things, but I can break, so this is a Wikipedia entry. I'm creating my view of that world.
You're talking about an interactive catalog almost.
Exactly. Because it has nothing to do with the catalog, because I'm not trying to find a thing, I'm trying to build knowledge. Right? Not artifacts, knowledge. And so now, we all sign off, we're all happy with it, and Jeff Penka's driving home at night, he goes, you're not going to believe this, she did it again. And he adds another song. See, do I have this one? That's just the point. Because Julie Andrews rarely blocked it out to it. Right? So now we find out that Gwen Stefani has like a Sound of Music fetish, which you may or may not have found through Google. But the other thing is I can leave that scape open so other people, just like when I remember I dragged that lyrics in but it had all the other connections, now people could connect to mine and connect to another one. Local history. I'm doing a genealogy tree where this is Uncle Fred and Al, whatever. People can begin to connect in and agree and disagree. Now imagine if our patrons could build that around their topics, connect their topics together, and our other patrons could, and then our libraries could be connected. And so now instead of WorldCat, where we're sharing our list of stuff, we're sharing our understandings of our members and our communities. That's what we begin to move to. It makes Wikipedia look pale in comparison to what we could do with this stuff. All right? Now, what can we do with this on top of it? Well, we can take this information, and where did that search come from? In other words, like, did that search and Rich Girl popped up? Where did it come from? Well, it came from all of those connections that people are building. So we mentioned before that most modern search engines are built on something called page ranking. If you dig down deep enough, they're around this concept. This is why Google was brilliant. Google was not the first web search engine. If you go back far enough, you like me, you'll remember AltaVista was going to answer all our questions, and then Excite was going to handle, you know, was going to eat their bacon, and then suddenly this weird thing came out, and that's all we used. Right?
That's because of
this. The major assumption that Google made, and by the way, it's an assumption and then relatively untested, was that it wasn't the words on a page that mattered, it was what those words were connected to. That there was, what's a big fancy term, a topology on the internet. And so the pages point to each other, and things that are most pointed to are more important. And things that those more important pages point to, they're less important, but more important than these. They came up with this whole system of page ranking. And it works wonders. The problem is, anyone remember the phrase Google bombing? Oh, Google bombing was brilliant. During the first Bush years, if you type the word George Bush presidency in, or no, George Bush failure, it would point to the White House page. Failure didn't occur anywhere on the White House page about George Bush, I promise you. What a bunch of bloggers did was they all agreed to use the same words with the same pointer to the White House page. 3 days later, if you type George Bush failure, it pointed to Hillary Clinton's site. And it became this manipulation. And in fact, I don't know about any intelligent designers in the room, But if you're into Darwinian evolution, looking at what's called search engine optimization, it's amazing to see what happens, because they're open discussions where people say, oh, I'm going to use this to trick Google, and the Google people are reading it, so they fix their search engine, and so the people have to come up with a new strategy and a constant evolution. If you remember the days of meta tagging, we were going to put these meta tags on our pages and make them easier to find until we realized that people with trying to sell shoes always put sex, 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 sex up in meta tags because everyone was searching for sex, and no one saw that on your page because it was a meta tag. And so Google said, no more meta tags. So then everyone put sex, 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 sex at the bottom of their pages in the same color as the background. Right? So no one could see it unless you looked for it, but it was still picking it up with Google. And so then Google said, if you do that, we're blacklisting you. And then it became the size of type and all this kind of evolutionary. But the point is that this works well, but it can be manipulated. Imagine instead we came up with something like reference weighting, where we take credible populations like the library industry, and every day doing reference, they're citing different sources on the web. And we already know from that previous graph that people see librarians as highly credible agents. And by the way, you know perfectly well that when someone walks into a desk, you're all librarians. You guys may feel the burn, but our members have no clue. Nor should they, right? So I'm not going to make the distinction either. But the point is, imagine if we looked at what you guys were sending people to and used that as a weighting mechanism. So now when I search on whales or what have you, the thing that pops to the top are the things that credible agents search the most, point to the most. And not only that, I can use the words of how people are doing this inquiry as opposed to the words on the page. So you've also run into this running. Do a search on running. In your catalogs or on Google, you'll have the same problem. You will get running as a physical activity and running a business and running a project, right? Because the word running, right, it's just a word. Well, imagine, though, what we have is someone starts asking for jogging resources and we send them to running sites. If they type in the word jogging, we should get them to those sites because we know the text they use to ask those questions. So what we can do is every day, thousands of libraries around the world are answering questions and pointing people to resources like web pages and books and articles and music and people and organizations. Imagine if we took those, which is representative as baseball beach ball dots, we know the connection between them, this page points to this page, etc. We can begin to use this for a search engine. And one of the search engines right now, basic search engine, has this model. Web page points to web page. I don't care if you're talking about Google or Yahoo or Bing, my favorite search engine of the day. They point to web page. The problem is, you don't really know much more than that. A great professor colleague of mine once said there are three ways to become a highly cited scholar. Say it first, say it last, or say it stupid. If you say it first, people cite you as the seminal article. This was the groundbreaking study by. You say it last, it was the summative article. In the field of, as summarized by. And if you say it stupid, they have to cite you to tell you that you're stupid. Dave said, that's a citation. I'll take it. Right? What we really want to get to is something like a librarian or library points to resources. And eventually we want to get to a library pointing to a resource, a book, a person, an organization. And then eventually we can get to credible agent pointed to or had some relationship to an item. Now, that's as horrible as it sounds, but it means things like librarian endorsed, librarian opposed, librarian liked, didn't like, thought was relevant for, whatever. But it can also be lawyer pointed to, doctor recommended, tax accountant, IRS agent thought. So you get all these credible agents pointing to this. And then we can begin to expand things by making assumptions like, well, if the librarian pointed to this as a highly credible site, and this page pointed here, we can assume it's a credible site, but maybe not as credible. And so one could imagine a simple interface where you could begin to step down from, I'm not so much worried about credibility, give me more stuff, and find out further and further what people pointed to. We know from studies of reference, for example, that people will use the exact same words to ask for very different things. So, If a student, let's say a doctoral student walks in and he's trying to do his topic on his dissertation,
That student will ask for everything you've got on top accounts. Everything. Because they're fishing. They just want to go through and find interesting ideas and sort of wallow for a while. The day before that doctoral student defends their dissertation, they will walk into the library and they will say, tell me everything you've got on. What they're looking for is stuff they missed. They're trying to worry about their defense, about someone's going to bring up an article they hadn't thought of. Same words, same question, radically different response. Right?
So we can begin to get at that. We can take all these recommendations and we can put that into an architecture, and then we can push it out to different search engines, build our own search engine. Yay. But we can also imagine this as a general infrastructure, because this is a project we call Reference Extract, and we put it out there, and a lot of people said, not another search engine. We said, you're right. Imagine taking another popular search engine. And someone's searching for resources, but now what we can do is if they run it through that, what we can do is you go ahead and use the Moodle, but we'll highlight things that librarians find credible right within that interface. Because we also know that from lots of studies about credibility, people don't always care about credibility. They sort of have a switch. It's usually based on the cost to them for the answer. Britney Spears' next concert, don't care about. Cancer treatment next week, care a lot about. Right? So they can either take it or ignore it. But we can also take this and build it into our inventory systems. Right? So here's a standard catalog thing. If you like this book and you want more like it, click here and we'll take those terms and phrases and find out what other reference libraries thought were credible resources around. So we can begin to expand it into this collection. We can put it into all different kinds of interfaces like a virtual reference system so it can suggest answers or resources we may want. And by the way, if it's not in there, people go to Google, people go to the databases, they can add it so the next time as you use the service and add to the service, it gets better and better and better. All right. Where are we going from here? Good question. Remember this quote that I read to you? This is Joan Bechtel. I want to finish the quote. This is where she's saying we don't know what we're doing, we're not doing whatever. A more powerful alternative to the images of librarianship already available or proposed, I suggest, that we begin to think of libraries as centers for conversation and of ourselves as mediators of and participants in the conversations of the world. So even back then, she was talking specifically in academic libraries about teaching students not about Library of Congress, but teaching them about scholarly communication and what the process of scholarly communication, what peer review means, and how not everything is peer reviewed that's in a journal, these kinds of things. But even then, we were starting to talk about the idea of conversation. Knowledge, being created through conversation, is the business that we're in. Now, when we put out this idea of reference extract I just showed you, it was interesting some of the comments we got back. This was just sort of an open comment. Now, that's an interesting idea. Quality instead of quantity. Of course, we have to ask ourselves, what took librarians 10 years to realize that? I do note that being a librarian is kind of a slow profession, but still, it's not like we couldn't have collected high-quality links a long time ago. How many people on your library website have high-quality links? For the past 10 years, you've been doing it. But we haven't necessarily gotten to people's awareness of it. And that's for a lot of reasons. OCLC did a study where they asked, what are the words you most associate with libraries? Number one, books. Now the question is, what do we do with that? First of all, do we believe it? Well, that's our major fault. In which case, we would end up back with that Kindle site and say, if we're the book business, we've got a problem. I mean, if we're the book business, we've got a problem. Take people who know they're in the book business, booksellers. They've got a problem, and they know it. Take people who, for example, have highly identified themselves with their tools and not their purpose. One example of an industry that has highly identified itself with its tools and not its original purpose? Newspapers. How do you feel if you're a newspaper reporter these days? Right? And we talk about the idea of newspapers imploding and such, and people, it's the end of journalism. Have they forgot to turn on the TV recently? Because there are plenty of journalists around that's just not selling newspapers. Well, if we identify ourselves, it's for example, there's this fellow out of India, Ranganathan, and he defined five laws of librarianship. And the first one is books are for use. And they're seen as a highly important document. But Raghunathan, if he were living a couple thousand years ago, probably would have written scrolls are for use. And before that, stone tablets are for use. And the idea that somehow the book has become magical to us is irrelevant.
We're in the knowledge business, not the thing business, not the artifact business. If we do what we do right, we make our communities better, not more bookable, not more book-loving, not more...
If you're in the book business, how many times have you audited and done assessments of how expensive your books are and how much they're worth today? If you're in the book business, you've done a crappy job of it because we take books, we rip off the good binding, throw away the dust cover, put a piece of plastic on it, and let people read it. Right? If you're in the book business as an artifact, you don't do that with the Gutenberg Bible. Right? Oh, no.
We're in the community. We're in the meeting business, meeting space. How many of you have taken lessons on how to do proper business meeting planning? Right? How many of you have gone to hospitality management people to worry about how we organize things that way?
We're in the knowledge business, and it's a brilliant business to be in. So I come back to that 30,000-foot view.
Some people would say starting up there in the ether and the theory and talking about knowledge and how knowledge is constructed is useless. Trust me, I've heard.
Why have a worldview? Well, because if you have a worldview that you feel is comprehensive and understand why people do things at a basic level, and you don't define librarianship as a series of functions.
When I asked you the Amazon, Sears, Google question, you are absolutely right to say, wait a minute, if we define librarianship functionally, we are in their business. If we do information dissemination, Google is in our business. If we do it as item management inventory, Amazon is in our business. If we do it as help desk answering, Sears is in our business. At a functional level, you're absolutely right. But if you talk about the underlying level of why we do things, knowledge creation, you have to go to a fundamental understanding of what knowledge is. And that shapes how you offer services. So why do we not have two grand pianos on a stage? Well, that's not what libraries are for. Well, why not? Why not? How many people have heard the Library of Alexandria? Right? You heard of the Library of Alexandria? This is our great predecessor. 3,000 years ago. Right? It was supposedly burned to the ground. A lot of people point to this and say, that's the first library. Here's the trick. The Library of Alexandria was known in the ancient world as having the largest collection of documents ever. In fact, they had a brilliant policy. They were a major seaport. And any ship that came into harbor, they would send soldiers down and confiscate every document they had on the boat. Bring them up to the library where they would be copied, and they would give the copies back to the boat to keep the original document. I think this is something New York State should consider. Anyone coming in from another state, we stop them and take all their books, copy them, and give them the copies back. But, and anything else valuable in the room? What's interesting is people look at, Library of Alexandria, the greatest collection in the world. But it wasn't. It was actually a campus. And so the first building on the campus was actually a building dedicated to, I'll do my little Greek columns, the Muses. And in the building dedicated to the Muses, they put all the documents, all the scrolls, all the poetry, all the music. In fact, it was dedicated to the Muses, and it's where we get the phrase museum. Because it was called the Musée. Over here, the large building that was part of the Library of Alexandria was actually a dormitory that housed scholars from around the ancient world. It was one of the first economic development efforts in the ancient world, where they would bring scholars in from Greece and across the world, tax-free, give them a stipend, to sit and talk and think and walk around in the colonnade. They designed the building so that you had to run into your neighbor. And if they happen to think of something brilliant and write it down, guess what happened to the thing they wrote down? It went into the musée. The musée, the museums, are in the thing business. The library, from its origin, has been in the thinking business, has been in the thought business, has been in the knowledge business. And why is it that every time people say we're dead, we don't die? Because they keep looking at the tools and assume that tools are the same, so therefore the functions are the same, and therefore you've been replaced. And what keeps happening is the libraries keep changing to say, wait, I don't care what the tools are. My job is to make my community better and have them make better decisions. Right? That's an activist stance. My job is to make our community better. And we do that by providing the materials. And so if it's musicians, we provide musicians. That concept of building services
turns into search engines. Now, once again, not all librarians buy this. And this is where I get to show you the annoyed librarian, or as I call them, the annoying librarian. Anyone know who the annoyed librarian is? Library Journal has put an anonymous blogger on their site where they basically get to be cranky. Just such bravery, I can't tell you. And the annoyed librarian got a hold of this reference extract idea I ran through and didn't like it. And the first thing they were trying to say is, you can never compete, libraries can never compete with Google. As if Google even existed 10 years ago. Let's remember, Google was a bunch of two failed doctoral students out of Stanford starting their garage. Right? They didn't. Yeah, anyway. All right. And libraries? They're higher library school graduates. In the case the penny hasn't dropped, let's do the comparison in our heads. On one hand, we have the best engineers and programmers in the country, and on the other hand, we have library school graduates. Unless the ALA can lobby successfully for some anti-competitive labor standards favoring librarians, I don't see how librarians are going to compete.
And librarians,
really. A little bit? Yeah. It's just like the engineers don't go to the same damn universities as the librarians, but somehow we, you know, second-rate universities. Anyway, librarians should just relax. Because they're not going to reinvent anything. They never have.
This is a librarian's
library? Yeah, hello. Right, yeah. They never will. That's not what libraries are for, but a lot of librarians get all hot and bothered that they can't compete in a field they never should have entered in the first place. Ladies, gentlemen, I would say that if you ever hear a phrase that's similar about libraries, assistants, aides, or whatever title you want to take on about, oh, they're not librarians. It's the same kind of crap attitude that this is. That this is the field looking at itself and saying, we're not good enough. I find this not only deplorable and lazy, but unethical, that if you really feel that way, you should get out of the damn field. And by the way, if librarians look at you folks that have amazing skills and connection with communities and do the same thing, oh, you don't have your MLS. Oh, then they should get the hell out of the field, too. I'll be real honest. Because we are in a field where we want to change the world. We, as the library field, and I want to be real clear here, librarians, librarian assistants, the people who fund them, the people who handle them, the field, people who care and love libraries, we have an obligation. We have an obligation of service. Yes, we must be of service and provide service and do good for the community, but that does not mean transparent and invisible. We also have very much an obligation of innovation. There's an obligation for us to do better. There's a great story I have. Everyone thinks when you think innovators, oh, Steve Jobs, and you know, if you're a classicist, you know, Edison, and all these other things. One of my favorite innovators in the whole world's name is Joey Besson, and he was the owner of the Syracuse Nationals, the Nats, right, back in the 50s when there was one. And Joey Besson invented something called the shot clock. He didn't invent it, but he was the first one to install it. Now, if you watch basketball at all, you know the shot clock. He said it's 24 seconds, and it varies by league. But where did the 24 seconds come from? All right. I digress, but stick with me for a minute. Before the shot clock, scores in basketball games were something like, you know, 30-2, you know, or 15-8. Because as soon as you went up, your job was to take the ball and do this. And not let the other team get the ball. It was a defensive game. And this drove Besson nuts because it wasn't very fun to watch. And in fact, that means that not many people pay the money to come watch it. And so what he did is he said, I want them to score 80 points a game. He took 80 points, divided by the number of seconds in regulation play, and came up with 24 seconds. He said, the minute you get the ball, you have 24 seconds to shoot. Now, the effect of this was the game became faster. And not only did it become faster, but it moved from a defensive game to an offensive game, which increased the importance of point guards and centers and tall people, because then it became how to score faster and more certain, and that led to things like slam dunks, and much more enjoyable to watch. And what's interesting is when basketball became sort of faster paced, easier to watch, when television was looking for more sports to put on TV, they found basketball because it fit the format very well, it was exciting to watch. TV picking up basketball led to huge contracts and endorsements of the NBA, which has led to its multi-billion-dollar-a-year industry we have today from someone who had a very simple idea, which is you have 24 seconds to shoot the ball. Now, what's interesting about that innovation story is Doug Besson didn't sit there and go, how am I going to turn this into a multi-billion-dollar industry? He looked at a problem right in front of him and came up with a simple solution that had massive implications. Librarians, library aides, library assistants, funders of libraries, people in libraries have that obligation to innovate. If we are in the knowledge business, and if knowledge is change, to learn something new is to change your worldview, we must constantly be doing that amongst ourselves. How can we expect to produce radical positive change if we are not organizations of radical positive change? If we are conservative, slow-moving organizations, God knows. But if we look at sitting on the reference desk, we can do this better. Right? We're just having a conversation about scheduling students at an academic library. If we can innovate that process to figure out how to get students to show up at 8:30 in the morning, I think the conclusion we came was penalizing them by making them organize videos if they don't. But that little thing may lead to bigger and bigger consequences, right? It may lead to nothing, but we have to attempt and innovate, right? So I don't care if you're checking out books. I don't care if you're organizing the reference staff. I don't care if you're putting up the whole catalog. Eli Nyberg, one of my favorite guys in the world, who built Ann Arbor District Library's new library interface. He's a degree in architecture, but it's totally revolutionized how people think about catalogs. I keep trying to push them through, right? That's our obligation, and we have an obligation to make it better. And we have an obligation of leadership. So if you, according to the vision, and I buy and I love this vision, one of your goals is to be part of the decisions that affect your life, you have an obligation to lead in those decisions, to be aware of those decisions, to innovate and think of how it can be made, and to make that voice loud. And I know. You have been in settings where every time you try to stand up and say truth to power, it has slapped you down. I know you carry scars of apathy. Not yours, but from other people. I know you've had brilliant ideas that have been shot down because of status or ignorance or unwillingness. I know. And I'm asking you to do it again. And I'm asking you to keep standing up. And frankly, if you keep standing up and no one's listening, I ask you to go somewhere else that will find and appreciate it. And I understand what that means. I've got kids. I'm not ready to get up and listen. But ultimately, that's the game that we're in. If you got into this profession because you love books, it's going to be hard to stay in this profession. I tell this to people interested in library school. If you want to become a librarian because you love books, don't go into one. If you love reading, you're never going to have time. Right? If you want to come into this because you want to improve your community to make better decisions and knowledge, this is the place to be. All right. Questions, comments? What did I get wrong? Things to think about.
Are there libraries who are doing things?
There are. And as with all things, you're going to find uneven applications. But when I look around, so for example, we came up with these great ideas from Philadelphia Free Library, and then they had to close 11 branches because of an economic crisis, and it stopped. So the last thing they were going to do is start new services from there. So we all have that reality. But if you look at, for example, what Sarah Feldman does in Cuyahoga County, which is outside of Cleveland, Ohio, doing brilliant stuff they call the Agora, they've got the University of the Public Universities. You look at some of the things that are going on in Herkimer County Library in Minnesota, where they're putting online questions and answering. You look at, in public sectors, look at, well, I just took all the time to, you know, talk about how tagging's horrible. If you actually look at PenPax, which is out of the University of Pennsylvania, they built a whole system that really is how to capture knowledge from the catalog and all these other sources and bring it together. So they call it tagging, but it's not. It's close to social bookmarking. There are lots of examples where your Ann Arbor District Library, their gaming program. Gaming programs are where a lot of this innovation is occurring because people looked at gaming originally, and gaming will fail, just like blogging will fail if you do it for the wrong reason. If you look at gaming and blogging as a marketing ploy, librarians, libraries, suck at marketing, right? What marketing says is we have a product and we want to convince you need to know it. Ask backwards, right? What we want to know is what do you need to know? Let's figure it out. And when you look at what gaming has done, gaming has really been the new form of literacy. Gaming is a social activity. So, for example, a lot of gaming programs started out as setting up their LAN environments, their Unilab environments, bringing people in where they were playing Doom or Marathon or these things, and it was just kids staring at screens. And kids can stare at screens in the library, they can stare up in their room, and as soon as they had better bandwidth in the room, they were gone. Right? What they realized is, wait a minute, the Wii does something really different. People are bowling together, right? People are doing Dance Dance Revolution together. People are doing board games. Scott Nicholson, one of my colleagues at Syracuse, looks at teaching information literacy through gaming, the new form of narrative and problem solving, these kinds of things, because that's building knowledge, as opposed to that's entertaining the masses or that's bringing more bodies into the library. You want to bring more bodies? Here's the strategy to increase traffic in your library 500%. You want to bring people in the library? Go for porn. Brings them in every time, right? Make sure you darken your room, your windows first. But my point of this is, that's not why we're here, right? We're not just here for body counts. We're here for knowledge. How we market them, get them aware of us. I don't want to say marketing's useless and irrelevant, but I want to say you've got to make sure that you have some. Right? My big thing with is, they're all coming to us because of the economic crisis. Well, how do we keep them when they bring their money back, right? How do we not become the Walmart that, oh, they can afford Amazon again, right? If we can get them in for, oh, you get your DVDs for free, Oprah apparently just realized that the other day, then how can we keep them so that, you know, later they go, you know, I went in for that book, and I found out that I can learn how to do a business plan here. I came in for this book, and I found out that there's a gaming program that my 13-year-old loves and is part of. Eli Nyberger, once again, who set up a gaming program in Arbor, said, the library used to be a net detractor of social capital for 13-year-old boys. 13-year-old boys never wanted to be seen in the library because that meant, you know, they were nerds and geeks. He started a gaming program, and they would come in and they would do gaming in tournaments. And on the website, they would keep who got the top tournaments. And now all the 13-year-old boys were dragging people to the library website saying, look, I own them, right? I own them. It became a net asset, net social capital asset. But that's even to the point of, oh, it's gaming, it's just a distraction. It's not a lost leader. That's the other thing. You look at gaming, you go, well, we'll get them in, and then we'll, like, when they're not looking, we'll slip them Aristotle, right? You know, no. Gaming now accounts for a larger industry than the entertainment and movie industry. It's one of the largest industries in this world. We should be preparing people to deal with this environment because that's knowledge, not things, not stuff, not what we have behind our shelves. How do they make better decisions? So there are more examples than that, but those are a few that you can look at. Gaming is a good one because they're starting to think about it as participation and knowledge. You're looking at Pentax as a specific technology and Ann Arbor as a specific technology implementation. Embedded librarianship in the medical library sector. A lot of academics, you might have subject bibliographers, right? People, librarians who are supposed to sort of know what to buy. Well, what we're talking about is getting staff out there. And by staff, I mean all kinds of staff. Philadelphia Free Library has an amazing volunteer program run by a staff member. And when they talk about service to the African-American community, they have a hard time breaching it because a lot of people see Philadelphia Free Library as a very white, very municipal, very border kind of place. But now what they're doing is they're sending their volunteers from that community out back into the community going, what do you need? I'll bring that book for you next week. Or, hey, if you come to the library, I can set it up for you. Or, right, and so it's actually something where librarians have that creepy treehouse thing we talked about before, right? I'm a librarian. I'm here to help you. But if you're coming back to your own community that you're a part of and saying, you know, I've been here for 30 years. We need this in the library because our communities need it, and we need it out of the library. That's important. So examples like that. Other questions or comments? Thoughts? Thank you, Greg. I really appreciate it.